Hello and welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, US writer and broadcaster Webster Tarpley talks about the Venetians and their influence on the intelligence services today. Plus, miscarriages of justice are growing in Britain, in part due to the extinction of investigative TV documentaries such as the BBC's Rough Justice. But fear not, to the rescue is victimsunite.net website and editor Sabine McNeil. Plus our weekly news and disability update with Jason Yannakopoulos. But we start this week with Sabine McNeil from victimsunite.net. Hi, Sabine, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
We haven't heard from you for a little while, but there's a lot going on this week, isn't there? First of all, some horrendous increase in charges for McKenzie friends. Now, first of all, in court, what is a McKenzie friend?
A McKenzie friend is a lay legal advisor, and we refer to ourselves as voluntary public interest advocates because we never charge, and we have gone into this assistance of litigants of in person because we visited people in prison, and we have mainly had the bad experiences in family courts. But McKenzie friends have been around also in civil courts and in criminal courts, and some of them charge. Ironically, there has just been a report published on fee-charging McKenzie friends, and that's where I learned that only 6.5% of the general public know about McKenzie friends. And in the publication of their 15 recommendations, it was suggested that a more positive picture of McKenzie friends needs to be painted. Well, our McKenzie Friends website has had quite a number of hits, especially because we published the petition to abolish adoptions without parental consent, and we've been to Brussels to present the petition there. So that is the voluntary public interest angle. In other words, a McKenzie friend is anybody who is a non-trained in law and who helps with common sense, with heart and passion, and that's what we are about.
But don't the lawyers get a bit annoyed, because surely they're missing out if you've got people coming in to help someone who's being represented in court for free?
Well, you don't necessarily represent people in court. I mean, that is sort of, it seems to me, always the big bait and the big fear, whether you do or don't get a right of audience, as it's called. But it's totally up to the discretion of anybody's judge. And I've been in situations where we were allowed into court, but you don't speak. You then only whisper and pass notes to your friends or the claimants or the clients or whoever, the people that whom they try to help. You may or may not get in. You may or may not have to hand in your CV. And that's why we actually will help, hopefully, Sir James Munby to write some kind of guidance and practice notes from based on our experiences of what needs to happen. A, there has to be a kind of a better unification of how McKenzie friends are being treated across various courts. And certainly there has to be made the difference between family courts and civil courts and criminal courts.
Now, I noticed in The Telegraph, Christopher Booker's writing just this weekend about a case involving a ruling by Mrs. Justice Ingrid Simler,
yes,
saying that this costs ruling in the family courts is going to penalise those who are helping parents who've been wronged. McKenzie friends now risk severe financial penalties if their case is lost. Or now, so what's happening there?
Well, we've just been to the Royal Courts of Justice to file the documents necessary to oppose this. And ironically, we were not on the system, we were told. So they had problems. They didn't have any problem taking our money. They had just raised the fee from £80 to £155 for such an application.
Okay, that's nearly doubling. Is that's a little bit above the rate of inflation?
A little bit, I'd like to say, too. And I asked at least for a new schedule of fees so that one can get used to these wonderful
figures. I thought extortion was prosecuted by the courts, not practiced by them.
Well, you'd think a lot about fairness and justice. And, I mean, one of the aspects was one would have expected some improvement when one tries to file documents, but now there's even less space and even less chairs and even less staff and even less anything. But you can have a direct debit facility, so if you're a regular litigant and want to throw more money at the courts. So what we did to defend this ridiculous costs order, I mean, obviously we don't believe that we should be penalised.
I mean, just explain, I mean, who is paying the costs and why?
Well, so far nobody, we don't want to pay. We have been ordered to pay, but we oppose. That's the application that we put in this afternoon. Why? Because to set a sign so that people get discouraged. That's why John Hemming published on his blog also about something about this. He's just like Christopher Booker and like Ian Josephs, of course. This is absolutely terrible because there has to be some way of opposing anybody or anything what's happening in the courts, and especially by volunteers. And how and why volunteers should then become financial victims is certainly beyond anybody's idea of justice and fairness.
Also in the news this week, actually a possibly bigger revolution is being called by some in the family courts. A new family court will deal with divorce and child custody proceedings, and it's going to be introduced in England and Wales. The court will replace the previous three-tier system as part of a revolution in family justice, Sky News says. Another significant change is a 26-week time limit on care proceedings aimed at protecting children. It follows a review of family justice in 2011, which found vulnerable and damaged children were having their futures undermined. So often cases can take a year or more. Supervision cases. So do you think this is really a revolution? Is this good or bad?
Certainly not. I mean, it's just a kind of a facade, I would say, that is being made, and it's part of spin, but it doesn't cut down to the problems that we've been hearing and seeing and learning about and trying to help, where local authorities take children willy-nilly. Do you know that even Channel 4 quoted one child taken every 20 minutes in the UK? When I talked to the Petitions Committee in Brussels on March 19th, I said I'm here on behalf of the 1,000 children that are taken every month. And that is not because of custody battles, i.e. private law. This is public law. If you want to oppose as a parent to a local authority who take your child because of the risk of future emotional harm, then you are really not covered. I mean, and because all of the power lies in the hands of the local authority. They are the ones who pay the courts. They are the ones who pay the police, who help the social services to take the children, and they invent all of the allegations afterwards. I mean, it is really too hard to believe, Tony. The Portuguese couple whose 5 children were taken in April last year by, I can't remember how many, police and social services, without papers. We don't need to show. We don't need to show you papers. They, 2 days after they came back from Brussels, they were arrested at 7 o'clock in the morning without any warrant, without any papers, held without food. The mother was in pajamas for 12 hours. When they came back at night, the whole place was ransacked. And what did they find? A warrant, a search warrant. It doesn't say who issued it, but looking for the evidence of the forced adoption group. They were charged with abducting 3 of their 5 children. I mean, you can't make it up. It is just so far-fetched. But it was clearly the attempt to criminalize them and to imprison them. Well, because of our invention, we and publicity in Brussels and around Brussels and in Portugal, we now got the embassy to negotiate with Lincolnshire Council, and as a result, the children are promised to be returned. But that is the second of such a case. The first one was Slovakia, where it took 920 days for the boys to be returned. This is now less than a year. But that's the kind of angle that the new family court is not going to make.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, surely the one positive thing is that hopefully these things will happen more quickly, certainly if it's taking over a year for parents to really even, you know, get a decision out of a court about what's happening with their children. That's awful. But I mean, you're German, Sabine, and, you know, the idea that you have to produce all the right bits of paper at all the right times, but when the authorities come to take your children, they don't need any kind of paperwork at all for it, no warrant, anything. This is rather totalitarian, isn't it?
Well, totalitarian, the cheating state, the police state, however you want to call it, Tony, it is obnoxious. It's perfidious Albion. That's what gets to me more than anything. This utter hypocrisy that is meant to be in the interest of the child. The court is meant to serve the interest of the child. It is so ridiculous. There is, Facebook is where all of the parents talk about their stories. One woman said, because she was in foster care before, 9 out of 10 children in care are being abused.
Well, there's really a lot of campaigning going on. And I know John Hemming is at the forefront of that, or at least one of the MPs that's been doing a lot. I mean, is he able really to make much of a difference, do you think, in Parliament?
He is consistently the only one who does. And I've just gone through some of his early day motions which illustrate that. He invited, for example, also 59 representatives of some 30 embassies, and he then tables the early day motion about international concerns. He also tabled an early day motion about Leah McGrath, who didn't get the visa to go to Jersey. And so he makes the links, he joins the dots, but he doesn't get much support. It depends very much. You know, early day motions are always a good measure of support amongst MPs. There isn't much happening, but he's with us, just like Christopher Booker is, just like Ian Josephs is, the veteran of it all in Monaco, who's been accompanying what we've been doing.
Well, keep it up, Sabine, is all I can say. We'll hear from you again soon. Just to remind listeners, it's victimsunite.net. And just give us an idea of the sort of stuff that you're doing on there, Sabine, finally.
Well, since Brussels was such a kind of surprise on a number of levels, we went there with a delegation of 30 people. I'm now pursuing the international arena, and particularly also because Slovakia, the first country, was surprised that their presidents didn't make much of a difference. So I'm now curious. I hope that Latvia is the next country, and sort of that the UK parents will benefit from all of the non-UK parents with whom we hopefully pave the way for things to change properly.
Well, Sabine, always great to talk to you. Speak to you again soon from victims-unite.net. Sabine McNeil, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thanks for calling, Tony. Bye.
Bristol Community FM, 94.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, Jason Yannakopoulos joins me for our news review. Before we start, Jason, Sabine McNeil, we just heard from there. She used to work at the large Hadron Collider thing, well, it was called CERN in the early days in Switzerland, as a network administrator, network coordinator, and she decided the whole thing was a complete waste of time and she'd go and network humanity rather than this giant great particle accelerator. But anyway, what goes on at CERN? You said you know a little bit about it. What is it?
CERN is a place to deal a lot with particle physics and sort of almost aeronautical physics and astrophysics, stuff like that. They do a lot of scientific work on, they do a lot of particle physics. I think I just pretty much explained it with that, to be honest.
And it's also, this is the sort of research that it's difficult to know what it's going to be useful for. It's just looking at the way the universe works.
Yeah.
What about this whole thing, business of the Higgs boson, the gold particle? Do you believe that that is actually, if you discover this particle, you have discovered God, or that there is no God, this particle is God?
Well, it's difficult to say because
I wonder what Mr. Cameron would say about it at the moment over Easter. He'd probably say, oh, yes, most definitely this particle is God or is there, or there cannot be no particle. I am God. So anyway, look, let's get down to the real news. And Cyril Smith is in it, I'm afraid, this week. He is, I believe, a dead Liberal Democrat, or Liberal, as he was at the time, MP. Very large man, very jolly, but as it turns out, a bit of a Jimmy Savile, if I can say that.
Yes, this is the problem of the poet I it said that of 35 years in which Fleet Street ignored the fact that Cyril Smith MP was predatory paedophile, the Daily Mail decided on its front page last Saturday there had been a monstrous cover-up. Now, points out here that Private Eye provided a detailed account of Smith's crimes as long ago as May of 1979.
Eye was supplying this information to the Daily Mail, and then they said there's been a cover-up. Well, maybe the Daily Mail is part of the cover-up.
Well, it would certainly seem so.
Now, what is interesting, this whole business of these people who have committed these horrendous crimes who are now dead. I mean, Jimmy Savile's obviously the most famous of them. I noticed the other day, just reading around the subject, that because of the Savile revelations, a lot of people have been raising questions from the past. For example, one of the Yorkshire Rippers victims was found only a stone's throw away from Jimmy Savile's home in Leeds, at Roundhay. So, you know, it does throw an interesting new light, if not a rather disturbing new light, on some past crimes like the Yorkshire Ripper. I mean, you know, no one's saying that Jimmy Savile did it, but it's a bit strange to find one of the victims was just around the corner from his house. The big problem, of course, being that Savile was meeting with West Yorkshire Police every week. He had his little clubs where he got together with these senior officers who were responsible for instigating prosecutions. And yet Savile was fraternising with them, Jason.
Well, yes, that is an absolutely massive travesty, really. The fact that while committing these horrible offences that he did, that he was meeting with police, I suppose, trying to get away with the crime, getting to know the police is probably a way to get round it.
Well, what about the former chairman of the Conservative Party, Chris Patten, who's now in charge of the BBC and has been for 5 or 6 years now? I mean, first of all, a bit strange that a former chairman of the Conservative Party should be made chairman of the BBC, or in fact of any political party. Does start to make it look as if the channel's very biased. I mean, the political editor, Nick Robinson, he's former chairman of the Young Conservatives, as Owen Jones pointed out in an article recently. But ultimately, what do you think about the way Chris Patten has dealt with the Savile scandal over the last couple of years?
Well, I think it was, well, the past couple of years, that's past 1 year. It was a...
Well, it's 18 months or so now.
18 months, year and a half. It was, he's dealt with it disgracefully, to be honest.
What do you think he should have done?
Well, I think they should have aired it. I mean, when he died, if it was such good, information in that, they should have aired it. Let's be fair.
That's right. And Liz McKean, of course, was a Newsnight social affairs correspondent, put all the information together, done the interviews, and then they just decided, oh, this isn't an interesting enough story. How appalling. Anyway, from Cyril Smith, Jimmy Savile, I'm afraid we do cover this one quite a lot because it's an important scandal to expose. But anyway, MPs' expenses. There's another scandal, Jason. We've had this one before too. What have you dug out from Private Eye about this one this week?
This one's quite interesting because they've done an expenses special where it talks about other MPs that have fallen guilty but not necessarily been caught. And they've targeted here Chris Grayling, the Justice Secretary, whose record, they say, is long overdue serious scrutiny.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Isn't it fascinating the way this all happened, this MP's expenses? Because it was a former SAS officer that arranged the hit, basically went in and stole this, which, of course, is a criminal offence, and then delivered it up to the Daily Telegraph. But you know what? Tony Blair's expenses records had been erased from the disc. Isn't that strange? So we never found out how much Tony Blair had been fiddling his expenses.
It points out here with Chris Grayling that he claimed mortgage payments on two properties in 2001, a house in Surrey near his Computer Belt Esher constituency, and
Esher,
also...
Esher, dear boy, Esher.
I do apologise, Esher constituency, and also a flat in London. And he already owned two other flats in London that were left out. He's been claiming for two mortgages is against common rules, but he told the fees office it was necessary because he couldn't get a 100% mortgage on the new London flat, No one seems to have asked why he couldn't have just lived in one of his other flats in London when the tenancy expired.
Well, how many flats does he need when there's nearly 2 million people officially homeless in Britain? Maybe he could just give up one of his places and let the state pay for it for someone who's actually homeless rather than him having several homes.
Well, yes, absolutely. It goes on to point out that he got the taxpayer to foot bills for when he tarred up his flat. He claimed £4,250 for redecorating in May 2005 and £1,561 for a new bathroom. In June of 2005, he claimed £1,341 for new kitchen units. In July, a further £1,527 for plumbing and £1,950 for rewiring the flat. That meant that he almost hit his maximum allowance for that year. It then goes to say that he delayed some of the bills for the following year so that he could claim further and have it counted onto the following financial year instead of that financial year.
Well, he's obviously trying to make sure he claims the maximum, Jason. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Well, the problem is that all this work happened in 2005, and by delaying it over 2 years, he was able to stay just within the laws, even if not honest. If he'd actually put all the receipts together at the same time, he would have exceeded his allowance by £4,700.
Oh, right. So what you do is you count up all your receipts up to the maximum amount. Any receipts that you've got, you just hang on to them and use them next year.
Yeah.
Oh, you naughty boy, Chris Grayling. Mm-hmm. It's just as well you were Justice, isn't it? Justice Secretary?
Yeah, Secretary of State for Justice. Yeah.
For Justice. So a bit of a naughty boy. Okay, next story. Russia and Mandy, that's Lord Mandelson, I suppose, the Prince of Darkness, and the gas market. So what's going on there? How's Mandy getting involved with the gas market? Is he negotiating with the Russians for cheap gas?
It would look like it. An early indication of how Russia can be hit economically by the EU intervention is a frost. Do you want to intervention in the Ukraine? It's to be anything more than token. Comes with stories that the EU will block any favourite product of Gazprom. However,
that's the Russian gas producing company, isn't it?
Who could intervene to save these wealth creating projects? By curious coincidence, British Chamber of Commerce conference this month, Peter Mandelson, who has many contacts in Russia, helpfully opined that all of our gas bills could be lower if the EU could negotiate a single purchase contract with Gazprom.
Ah, right. So Mandy's in charge of this energy contract. Listen, we all know the big energy companies are the biggest crooks on the planet. So Mandy's happy to be associated with them and cut some sort of massive deal with Putin to get cheap gas for the whole of Europe, and everyone can be grateful to him.
Yes.
Interesting. Kew Gardens. Now, I know the gist of this story, which is that a lot of people are going to be sacked there, it looks like, and it means that, you know, it's one of the jewels in the crown of the whole of Britain is going to be slowly getting weeds in between the plants and not attracting so many visitors as it used to. I mean, I've visited Kew many times over the years. Beautiful place, gorgeous place, fantastic. And I'm really sorry to hear that this government thinks that the weeds should be allowed to grow in between the plants. Kew in London is also the home to the Public Records Office, but its main job is a botanical gardens for Britain, isn't it? Which was once a famous botanical gardens, one of the most famous in the world because of the British Empire was so big. They were bringing plants and animals, well, actually plants for the botanical gardens, from right across the British Empire.
Well, yes, it's the same thing. The equivalent of 125 science and public education jobs are to go from the laboratories, where plants have been studied since 1759. Although Kew hopes to make some of the cuts by reducing working hours to keep products going, including ground staff and scientists, the gardens currently employ 750. Kew's funding is from DEFRA, that's the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, but it has been declining since 2010, of course, when the coalition government came in.
Funnily enough, the greatest thing I can ever remember about Kew is when we went as school children and we were all naughty smokers. And so we went into one of the big glass houses there, which was absolutely steaming hot on a sunny day. And we sparked up our cigarettes. And guess what happens when you spark up cigarettes in there? Fire. There's so much oxygen, the thing goes, it's like a little firework going off in your hand. But anyway, that was naughty schoolboys. Don't try this at home, folks. But very sad to hear that the government is crucifying just this. Is this government actually hell-bent on sabotaging the whole of Britain, Jason? Does it say anything about that in Private Eye this week?
I don't know, but it gives the impression.
Ah, right. Any pictures of Cameron with a bomb in his hand, or, you know, sort of little, you know, blowing up the railways, Kew Gardens, you know, all these various things seem to be destroyed. They do. I mean, you know, it seems to be that's what this government is up to, and I wonder if maybe that's good for business for other countries like America and Germany and Japan, possibly, are doing better because Britain is being so sabotaged.
Well, yes, it is.
It's just a theory.
Incredibly sad.
A death in custody as well this week, so let's get a little bit more somber.
See. Adding to the scandals engulfing the Metropolitan Police, Pepgate, corruption, undercover skullduggery, as they put it, came news last week that two more officers could face charges of perjury for threatening the cause of justice, this time over the death in custody of London musician Sean Rigg. The IPCC, Independent Police Complaints Commission, has handed prosecutors file of evidence relating to the inquest testimony of two officers involved in Mr. Rigg's arrest and detention. Mr. Rigg, who had schizophrenia, died in Brixton Police Station in August 2008 after being arrested in the street for assault. The jury at his inquest in 2012 decided the officers who restrained Mr. Rigg for several minutes before leaving him for a further 10 minutes in a police van in the station yard had used unsuitable force. The private eye also found out that two officers may face disciplinary charges of gross misconduct. Further, a total of five officers will now face a new criminal and disciplinary investigation over the use of force and care given to Mr. Rigg.
But surely the Metropolitan Police are above the law, aren't they?
Well, one would hope not.
Well, I mean, there's been something like one death in custody in Britain every month, and there's still been no prosecutions of any police officers for it for the past 30, 40 years. So, I mean, isn't that just impunity? They are above the law, aren't they?
Well, they're not supposed to be.
Okay, well, okay, so let's see what happens in that particular case. But also, you've got a story about the Serious Fraud Office, and I do always wonder when you get organisations like the SFO, the Serious Fraud Office, are they actually stopping serious fraud or committing serious fraud?
Well, this one's an interesting one. It's pointed out that David Green, who reaches halfway in his four-year contract as director of the Serious Fraud Office, or as the private eye has labelled them here, the Serious Farce Office.
Oh, right.
Since replacing Richard Alderman in April 2012, has done pretty much exactly what the coalition government has done for the last 4 years, and that's blame all the mistakes on his predecessor.
That's the easiest thing to do, isn't it? You say, nothing to do with me, folks. And then when you retire, the next person that takes over and does an even more disastrous job can blame everything on you. Yes, that seems to be the way this government works. Okay, more systematic sabotage.
Yeah, it says, seven cases where charges have been brought since 2012 were from investigations started under Alderman. Only the nine traders charged since last year with Libor rigging, the prosecutions involving former JGB sports chairman David Jones and his son Stuart, whose trial is due to start this week, and alleged £60 million art fraud are prosecutions at Green launch. And the investigation into JGB started under Alderman. The Green prosecution track record so far shows little to set against such embarrassing failures as the collapse of the Dardalay corruption trial last December.
Oh, that's right, yeah. This is all very embarrassing for the Serious Fraud Office. And in fact, I think that they're being sued over it. But I mean, it's just incredible, really, that somebody is being as soon as they start to actually do something, get a bit of teeth, then they seem to fall over straight on their face and then get sued by the person that they wanted to try and jail.
Yes, it's embarrassing. It points out the Dardalay case was started by Alderman but was actually brought to trial by Green, and
so he couldn't blame that on the previous chap, surely.
Well, he tried to.
He did try to. Oh dear. Okay, good old Serious Fraud Office, good old SFO. Farce or fraud, Jason? What's your verdict?
I think definitely a Serious Farce Office going on here.
Okay, and in the Eye as well this week, one of the front pages in the Eye newspapers, welfare reforms hit 2 million poorest families. What they say is a perfect storm of benefit cuts has blown massive holes in the safety net, warns Oxfam. The charity's calling on an absolute minimum level of income to keep people from the breadline. and the Department of Work and Pensions have come back at them saying, actually, work is the best way out of poverty. The only trouble is there ain't enough jobs. In fact, there's something like 30 people chasing every single job. So anyway, Jason, what's your thoughts about the way that welfare reforms have been kicking in?
Oh, gosh. I think if you want to see a working model of what the DWP now is, I think you need to read Oliver Twist in some places.
Oh, right. Yes, you're probably right. Victorian England. Nearly 2 million of the poorest families in Britain have been made poorer by the storm of below inflation benefit rises and also changes to the welfare system. Analysis by Oxfam and the New Policy Institute, they're also involved, found the worst affected 200,000 families were losing £860 a year as a result of benefit cuts. It concluded about 1.75 million households have been hit by changes to welfare payments, including fewer council tax exemptions and the bedroom tax. The charity called on the government to introduce an absolute minimum level regardless of where people lived, which would be high enough to prevent people from having to walk the breadline. Possible, or do we just not have enough money, Jason?
Well, it's all possible. We just need to release some of the capital that's being stored up by some of these, how do you put it, less savoury characters.
Oh, hang on. Starbucks, Vodafone, and some of the rich Tories.
Yes.
Okay, so sorry, folks. We're going to be taxing you to pay for these welfare benefits because there ain't enough jobs. And as soon as you start sorting out some jobs, people will be able to take them, won't they, and get off of benefits. Okay, Jason, well, thanks very much. See you again next week.
See ya.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And Ed Lander joins me now for our weekly technical chat. Elia's away in Spain for a couple of weeks. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Tony.
Now, this week, one of the interesting stories. Okay, we're going to talk about the Orwellian stuff in a minute, but the US, apparently, according to the BBC and Princeton University and the Washington Post as well, is not actually a democracy. It's an oligarchy or a plutocracy. That is, it's ruled by rich people. And one of the reasons they say that is that actually the government doesn't seem to do what the people want it to if you look at opinion polls.
Yeah, I don't think that's shocking to a lot of people. For me, I don't personally pay much attention to American politics and haven't done for some time because I consider it all a charade. And if you get information from the right sources, it's pretty clear who's pulling the strings in Congress, which is, I think, widely regarded as a completely and totally corrupt.
This is the New York Times take on it. They have an opinion piece on it. Do the rich call the shots, they say. A recent study by Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page examines 30 years of opinion surveys and policy decisions by the federal government, and they found that when a majority of citizens disagree with economic elites, they lose.
I think Occupy Wall Street was a good example of where people who spoke up for themselves with legitimate grievances were clamped down very hard indeed. You know, they were standing up to some incredibly powerful connected institutions in the finance sector, and they were being harassed and beaten and sprayed with pepper spray, arrested. It was, you know, pretty savage reaction to a totally legitimate and bang on campaign against inequality and oligarchy in America.
Well, this was published on the 21st of April. That's Monday this week. But interestingly enough, on the page, it says this article updated 22nd of April. So how strange. I wonder what was in the original article that wasn't in the updated article. I'm afraid the New York Times aren't telling us. So this kind of leads us on to our Orwellian discussion again, George Orwell. What's going on here? Because this is actually something that's talked about by Orwell, isn't it? The way that digital stories like that one we've just had a look at there can actually just be altered, and we're not even told that history has been changed.
Yeah, Orwell had a very interesting feeling about this, that in the Orwellian world it was pre-internet, so you didn't have all these digital stories, but you had books, magazines, newspapers. And when the leaders decided that history needed to change because they were now at war with a different people, they would recall all of these books and newspapers, all this literature, and literally manually rewrite it and redistribute it. And that, you know, it sounds incredibly complicated.
So you're talking about pulping the books and pulping it and then just reprinting stuff with a new version of history.
Absolutely. And therefore, if that's all you can get access to, then that becomes history and people get confused and start doubting their memories because they have all of this wealth of information that's telling them contradictory information to their memories. And now we've got everything digitized. It's online. It's much, much, much easier to rewrite history. You know, whether it's rewriting Wikipedia articles, re-editing news articles, ripping videos off YouTube, whatever it is, there are many, many ways that you can completely change history.
But surely something as big, for example, as the First World War, that's in some people, living people's memory still, that sort of history can't be changed.
Well, the way they teach
how much money you want to pay me.
The way they teach the First World War in school and the Second World War, it's so heavily simplified, and they don't talk about any of the aspects of European empires competing corporations, corporatocracies in Europe. They don't talk about that reason for the conflict flaring up. They just oversimplify all of it and talk about Imperial Germany. They're not talking about so much about the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the Brits or the Americans, any of it. And I think that's a case in point where history's already largely been rewritten and forgotten and drummed incorrectly into our skulls.
Yeah, we should, I think, go back and have another look at that. One of the things, particularly about the anniversary of the First World War this year, 100 years on from the outbreak of it, is this idea of Kaiser Wilhelm, the Tsar of Russia, and also our own King, George, being all cousins. And in fact, one way you can look at the First World War is simply a family squabble that got out of hand.
Yeah, and it's madness that can happen. And considering all the poor people who died at the hands of these warring empires, it's quite hard to come to terms with it in analysing it in that simplistic way of feuding between powers. But sadly, that really was the case. And there are lots of young, bright, ambitious people were swindled into giving up their lives for queen and country.
Well, guilt tripped, a lot of it was, wasn't it? I mean, they were told, if you don't go and fight for queen and country, then you're a coward. Yeah. And, you will be ostracised in your community. And in fact, a lot of people were who refused to. But there was still a lot of conscientious objectors too. One thing that amazes me about the First World War coverage is the way that Michael Gove, particularly the education secretary, has been trying to justify this. Obviously, he really should know better as Secretary of State for Education to try and talk about this being some kind of just war when it was a massacre and a slaughter. Mm. But the even more amazing, William Hague, the foreign secretary, is also saying it was a just war and a necessary war, where I think, that really, as I would have hoped anyway, that our education system over the last 100 years would have taught us that it was not just and it wasn't really for much. So anyway, your take on this, though, Ed, is in a way is that the internet can do even more than it was done in the past.
Well, I think that the ability of the internet to connect ordinary peoples around the world does empower us to stand up against war, in the sense that it helps us realize that we're all in the same boat, the 99%, and that takes away that ability for empires to pit ordinary people against each other and to form armies. But there is still, certainly at the moment, a very capable way of confusing and spreading disinformation and actively trying to stir up conflict using any number of methods on the internet, including now social media. And I think we're seeing a bit of a war there in trying to dominate the public conscious and to maintain the selective reporting, as you could put it.
Now, one of the stories I've seen changed reasonably recently is about the death of Robin Cook. There's quite a good article online, Lingering Questions About Robin Cook's Death. That's on, it's called shaphan.typepad.com blog. But the thing that absolutely amazed me is, I mean, I remember researching this at the time, about a year or so after Robin Cook's death. I mean, it's just put this in perspective. This is back in 2005, I think it was, that he was, Robin Cook was a very principled, actually probably 2004, Foreign Secretary for the Labour Party, and he completely disagreed with the decision to go to war, and he resigned on a point of principle in 2003 with Iraq. And then he died in what you have to call suspicious circumstances. I mean, the helicopter, which happened to be on a military exercise, came and picked him up when he was taken ill on Mount Stack when he was rock climbing. And this helicopter, military helicopter, turned up rather than an ordinary civilian, you know, sort of air ambulance. And his wife was told, no, you can't come into the helicopter too. To accompany him to hospital, and unfortunately, you know, because she wasn't with him, nobody really knows what happened. All we know is that he died on the way to hospital, even though he didn't really seem to be that ill when the helicopter arrived. So suspicious death. But then the thing that I find suspicious about this is that about a year after, a whole bunch of people who knew him, also people who used to go walking in the mountains with him, put a memorial to Robin on the rough area where this helicopter landed, where he was taken ill. And the local authority actually decided, no, we're going to take that memorial down. We're not going to allow it to stay there.
Wow.
And we're going to put it into a nearby cemetery away from the actual area where this memorial was. Now, that story I can remember, you have to trust me, but it's nowhere now. On the, and there was at least three or four sources and local newspapers where that the decision to move the memorial, now you won't find it anywhere on the internet. And so that little bit of history has been somehow wiped out. So I think what you're saying is you've definitely got a point there. But on the other hand, isn't the internet actually democratizing things more? It's allowing more freedom of speech. I mean, many people who are bloggers or whatever online, maybe, you know, 30, 40 years ago, would never have had a voice.
Yeah, it is an amazingly powerful tool. As long as people who have a healthy outlook on the world are able to get their message out, then it's incredibly useful. And I think the internet was particularly a powerful tool in the revolutions in Egypt, getting people talking to each other, trying to get them to bypass all the surveillance. You know, there was an incredibly powerful secret police organization in Egypt. And you even had people outside of Egypt trying to establish communication links when the Egyptian government, well, the military, effectively pulled the plug on the Egyptian internet. So people all over the world were working hard to support these Egyptians who had, you know, legitimate grievances, and they had real tenacity about it, and they were dogged about it. And each time they were given concessions by the government, they kept pushing for more and more, because they knew that first of all you have Mubarak, then behind Mubarak you had his cronies, you know, and then there are many layers of powerful institutions like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and they were saying, you know what, we want real democracy. We don't just want to peel back layers of the existing power structure. And they fought incredibly hard, and lots of people died in that regard. And I think a lot of that progress can be attributed to the internet.
But there was another, so I mean, I spoke to a photographer who was out there during the Arab Spring, and she was telling me how one of the fascinating aspects of it was when the government switched off the internet, everyone just came out on the streets
and backfired
and started chatting to each other about, ah, it's you, you know, I've seen you on Facebook or whatever, and actually started organizing in the streets, literally. And so maybe that kind of thing might backfire. Also, another thing I've seen online, which is definitely a change since the most of our stuff was print media. I mean, The Economist is one example of a magazine that very rarely has bylines. Now, you can read an article, but it's not by a journalist or a writer of any specific kind. It's just by The Economist. The BBC website is going this way as well, where, I mean, at least on the TV, you've generally got a reporter stood there talking to you, and you know who they are, and they've got a name. But a lot of the stories on the BBC website are just by the BBC, by The Economist. Now, I mean, it might sound pedantic, but getting bylines for a journalist is important, as to their reputation. But also, more importantly in a way, is if members of the public, professionals anywhere, have more information to add, say, for example, with something like the Jimmy Savile scandal, more information to add, well, they want to tell a journalist about, say, well, actually, here's a whole other side to this story, or maybe you got that fact wrong. They can't get to the original person that wrote the article. So this is a very, I mean, I think, you know, for many people reading, say, the BBC website, they don't even notice that kind of thing. But anyway, what are your thoughts on that aspect of actually being able to pin down something that's on a big authoritative website like the BBC to a specific journalist?
I think that's very important, because you have to hold journalists accountable. When people like Andrew Marr are trumpeting for war, we need to know that he was trumpeting for war, and it was his words and his decision to print that opinion. And I think perhaps there's much more of a active backlash to warmongering journalism these days. And so by having your name attributed to an article, you're putting out yourself out there for attack and rebuttal. And I've seen responses by journalists like Andrew Marr to people like Media Lens in their criticism of the responses, and they're very disrespectful and rude and derogatory. And so I guess they feel like by hiding behind a logo, then you're no longer culpable. And you could argue that, oh, we don't know who wrote that article that was pushing for intervention in Syria or in Ukraine, when that's exactly what we need to challenge.
So this idea of manipulating history, in Orwell's 1984, the Ministry of Truth was involved with news media, entertainment, fine arts and educational books, it says here on Wikipedia, which maybe we'll talk about in a minute, because of course that can be rewritten, just like Orwell's Ministry of Truth was doing. So for example, if Big Brother makes a prediction, it says, that turns out to be wrong, the employees at the Ministry of Truth go back and rewrite the prediction so that any prediction Big Brother previously made is always accurate.
Big Brother cannot be wrong, because that would make him fallible, and that would lead people to question him and question the statements he makes. So yeah, it's very important that he's not wrong, and he was never historically wrong, even if there's a sudden change in strategy that undermines statements he's ever said.
The idea being, really, that people are really... I mean, nowadays, the way this works is people are pushed for time. Not many people have got the time to read books, so they're getting a lot of their information through broadcast media. Mm. And the broadcast media is much easier to manipulate with a few centres. I mean, this is almost... It's a little bit eerie the way this is almost happening. I'm not saying that the articles are being rewritten, but certainly there are rewrites to articles taking place. I mean, I can remember, for example, a BBC article right at the very beginning of the war on Iraq, back in 2003, where the Arab League met to say and came up with a statement saying that to attack Iraq would open the gates of hell. Now, the BBC actually had that on their website as an article. I looked back maybe 15, 20 minutes later, the headline changed. Something completely different, like Arab League raises possible fears for future if war
Arab
takes
League
place.
Totally supports invasion of Iraq.
It wasn't quite like that, but
not that big.
You know, that's a good headline. As far as I'm concerned, the war could open the gates of hell. It's a quote from exactly what they've said, and also it's attention grabbing. But that sort of thing can be altered, can't it?
It was clearly too controversial, and as you say, even though it was a fantastic headline, it obviously caught the attention of the powers that be in the West, and they weren't happy with such.
Well, it will probably be
statement.
An editor at the BBC.
Well, who knows who they're in touch with? I mean, it's my understanding that the editors of the big journalist houses are some of the most connected people in the world. You know, they get to hear about all the injunctions. They get to learn about all the lobbying on the media industry.
Okay, so who is the editor of Points West, Ed?
I have no idea.
Well, it's funny because when Points West roll their credits, there is no editor. Mm. All you get on Points West is the name of the presenter. So right. The new editor, actually, his name is Neil Bennett.
Okay.
Used to be a guy called Lucio Mesquita, I think, who's now been made head of centre. Mm. But, you know, you go in, you have to actually go to the BBC or phone them up and say, who is your news editor? And, you know, I would like to see, as with the articles in The Economist and the BBC website, everybody who's responsible for something. I mean, what have they got to hide?
Well, I think one of the most notorious editors is Paul Dacre from the Daily Mail. And the Daily Mail is widely hated, quite rightly, for being one of the most prolific pieces of bigotry on the planet.
But yeah, but hang on a minute, because it's got the biggest circulation of any newspaper.
And the website as well.
A lot of people read, I read the Daily Mail sometimes, you know, because it seems to have a broader spread. It's very well financed. They've got a lot of original journalism in there. Also, you know, it's got a lot of the things that another newspapers like The Guardian would say, oh, this is not politically correct, we're not going to have this.
I just don't like the general flavour of news, so I subscribe to a boycott. Paul Dacre, I believe, is a particularly shy creature who doesn't like to come out in public and talk about his...
I don't think we've seen him on, say, Question Time. I mean, these people are extremely influential opinion formers.
Yes.
You know, I think we should be seeing newspaper editors like Alan Rushbridge from The Guardian, you know, Paul Dacre on Question Time.
I totally agree.
One problem, of course, is that we've got David Dimbleby in the chair, who was a member of the Bullingdon Club in Oxford with, well, not necessarily at the same time, obviously, but in the same elite club at Oxford as Boris Johnson, Mayor of London, David Cameron, the Prime Minister, and George Osborne, Chancellor of the Exchequer. Not really known for its left-wing views. So
yeah, I understand.
It's interesting, isn't it, how you can sort of self-select a Question Time panel to give you a particular spread of opinion, which is actually almost all right-wing opinion.
Yeah, not be controversial.
And to make the left-wing opinion, in this case, seem as if it's kind of slightly batty and isolated.
Yeah, that's a favourite tactic, is to invite some more left-leaning panellists on and just harangue them and try and upset them and try and rile them and get some outrageous statements out of them to just quickly discredit them. I saw a fascinating interview with, I think, Alistair Campbell haranguing the deputy editor from the Daily Mail and just basically slamming into Paul Dacre, saying that he was a coward for not coming on the show, and almost sympathising with the deputy editor, saying, I know that you've been told to say X, Y, and Z and you can't deviate, so this is kind of a pointless interview. But yeah, that's an example of these people hiding away.
Amazingly powerful broadcasting, and of course becoming consolidated in fewer and fewer hands.
Yes.
Also worth pointing out that Senate House in London is where George Orwell's wife worked at the Ministry of Information, and that was his model for the Ministry of Truth. And I do have a little fantasy where George Orwell is writing his 1984 down at the Bush House or the BBC somewhere.
Well, I've something I'm thinking about that's quite interesting is that now that we move away from paper media to digital media, particularly ebooks, wouldn't it be fascinating if all the copies of 1984 stopped being available? Wouldn't it be fascinating if the only copy of that was on an online archive? Wouldn't it be fascinating if you could no longer buy a copy of 1984 because it was deemed blacklisted and it was not available for sale as an ebook?
Oh, but it wouldn't be blacklisted, would it? Because it would be the new sanitized version. Anyway, Ed Lander, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Danny.
Well, we mentioned the Second World War there. Winston Churchill, who was running Britain during the Second World War, had a fantastic quote, very Orwellian, so to speak, straight from the Ministry of Truth. And he said, "History will be kind to me. I know, because I shall write it." Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly podcast for your MP3 player. Broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails, which go out every Tuesday evening at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Sabine McNeil from victims-unite.net and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute if you'd like to. Do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. So, that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening, so until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
We'll be right back.